two-body system all their life into a third column. Wallace had proved that you can bust the two-party system, because here is a man that's on 50 state ballots from one end of this country to the other. Now, I personally believe he had help from the Democrats, because I personally believe that the man couldn't have done it all by himself. There's too many Democratic-controlled towns that, with Nixon looking like he was going to win earlier, the only thing they could hope for was to throw it into the House. If it went into the House, a Democrat would get it. But I don't believe anyone in their right mind would ever believe that between last June and now, Wallace had found himself on all the state ballots. But he's done a lot. He's helped me to get my write-in votes counted in 45 states in America, or we're going to void the election, because on that Supreme Court decision, accidentally not pertaining to his case, the Supreme Court did say that every state have to count a write-in, that every state have to make it as easy for the citizens to vote. And this is very interesting, because the United States Constitution says that the states have a right to set up their own type of election. But when the Supreme Court said that you must make it easy as possible, that includes write-ins too.
Well, the large number of people are saying that when you get close to the election, that you must vote for Nixon or Humphrey, and particularly the Democrats, and appealing to black voters, say you have to vote for Humphrey, and they cite this lesser of two evils. How do you respond to that?
Well, that depends on the moral fiber of the person. The lesser of the two evils, if a man brought you two women, and one you had to choose for your wife, one was a prostitute 7 days a week, and the other was a prostitute on weekends, and if you did not have the moral dignity to say, I will go the rest of my life without being married, and you got slick and married the weekend prostitute, you're still married to a whore.
This is WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York.
So it all depends on the moral fiber of the person.
Lennox Raphael.
Do you feel very strongly that Wallace's victory will be disastrous for America?
No, I think Wallace has been the best thing ever happened for America. He's embarrassed America all over the world. We're going to lose multi-billion dollars in foreign investments because people think they see this Hitler thing now, and they're going to start pulling out when the going is good. And black folks have woke up, because now we got the first yardsticks in slavery to test it by. He's helped me tremendously because he got rid of that last little piece of nigger I had in my head. You see, the system put so many niggers in my head. My mom and daddy put so many. I've been married 10 years, but when I get through looking at my nappy hair and take my pashiki off, I still got to admit that 12 years ago I was trying to marry me a light-complected colored woman. Now, as I read all these things out of my head, the one thing I was never able to get out, that I was instilled from childhood, that white folks in America was Boss Charlie, that anything you wanted, you had to go through the white folks to get. And now Wallace had proved to me that white folks in America is not smart, that they are some of the dumbest people walking the face of this earth. Not because you rallied to Wallace, but simply because Wallace is a liar. He's the worst of the other two major candidates. Because if Wallace said, elect me president, I'll hold the niggas down, and I'll see to it that nobody get constitutional rights but who I want, that's groovy if somebody rallied to that. But he's not saying that. He's saying, if you will elect me president of the United States, I will uphold law and order. That's the same man that stood in front of the schoolhouse door to block law and order. He's saying that he is for the little man. Now, I thought white folks had enough intelligence to check this man out. In Alabama, you pay in Alabama the lowest property tax of any state in America. Alabama pays the highest sales tax of any state in America. So it's totally impossible for you to be for the little man when the property tax are the lowest in the country and sales tax is the highest, which means every time a man in Alabama go to get him some snuff or some Kool-Aid or some toilet paper, he's footing the bill.
Thank you. This is Kay Lindsay, and this has been a first in a series of programs, The Fourth Estate, which is BAI's answer to Meet the Press. All our reporters are black. They were today Ruth Ross, Earl Caldwell, and Lennox Raphael. If you are interested in listening to us again, tune in on November 18th at 9:30 p.m.
We bring you now a reading of What We Want by Stokely Carmichael, read by the former WBAI staff member Bob Ortiz.
What We Want. This is a reading of an article written by Stokely Carmichael, chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It appeared in the September 22, 1966 issue of the New York Review of Books. One of the tragedies of the struggle against racism is that up to now there has been no national organization which could speak to a growing militancy of young black people in the urban ghetto. There has only been a civil rights movement whose tone of voice was adapted to an audience of liberal whites. It served as a sort of buffer zone between them and angry young blacks. None of its so-called leaders could go into a rioting community and be listened to. In a sense, I blame ourselves, together with the mass media, for what has happened in Watts, Harlem, Chicago, Cleveland, Omaha. Each time the people in those cities saw Martin Luther King get slapped, they became angry. When they saw four little black girls bombed to death, they were angrier. And when nothing happened, they were steaming. We had nothing to offer that they could see, except to go out and be beaten again. We helped to build their frustration. For too many years, black Americans marched and had their heads broken and got shot. They were saying to the country, "Look, you guys, you're supposed to be nice guys, and we're only going out to do what we're supposed to do. Why do you beat us up? Why don't you give us what we ask? Why don't you straighten yourselves out?" After years of this, we are almost at the same point, because we demonstrated from a position of weakness. We cannot be expected any longer to march and have our heads broken in order to say to whites, "Come on, you nice guys," for you're not nice guys. We have found you out. An organization which claims to speak for the needs of a community, as does the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, must speak in the tone of that community, not as somebody else's buffer zone. This is the significance of black power as a slogan. For once black people are going to use the words they want to use, not just the words whites want to hear. And they will do this no matter how often the press tries to stop the use of the slogan by equating it with racism or separatism. An organization which claims to be working for the needs of a community, as SNCC does, must work to provide that community with a position of strength from which it can make its voice heard. This is the significance of black power beyond the slogan. Black power can be clearly defined for those who do not attach the fears of white America to their questions about it. We should begin with the basic fact that black Americans have two problems. They are poor and they are black. All other problems arise from this two-sided reality. Lack of education, the so-called apathy of black men. Any program to end racism must address itself to that double reality. Almost from its beginning, SNCC sought to address itself to both conditions with a program aimed at winning political power for impoverished Southern blacks. We had to begin with politics because black Americans are a propertyless people in a country where property is valued above all. We had to work for power because this country does not function by morality, love, and nonviolence, but by power. Thus, we determined to win political power with the idea of moving on from there into activity that would have economic effects. With power, the masses could make or participate in making the decisions which govern their destinies, and thus create basic changes in their day-to-day lives. But if political power seemed to be the key to self-determination, it was also obvious that the key had been thrown down a deep well many years earlier. Disenfranchisement, maintained by racist terror, made it impossible to talk about organizing for political power in 1960. The right to vote had to be won, and SNCC workers devoted their energies to this from 1961 to 1965. They set up voter registration drives in the Deep South. They created pressure for the vote by holding mock elections in Mississippi in 1963 and by helping to establish the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in 1964. That struggle was eased though not one, with the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. SNCC workers could then address themselves to the question, who can we vote for to have our needs met, and how do we make our vote meaningful? SNCC had already gone to Atlantic City for recognition of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party by the Democratic Convention, and had been rejected. It had gone with the MFDP to Washington for recognition by Congress, and had been rejected. In Arkansas, SNCC helped 30 Negroes to run for school board elections. All but one were defeated, and there was evidence of fraud and intimidation, sufficient to cause their defeat. In Atlanta, Julian Bond ran for the state legislature and was elected twice, and unseated twice. In several states, black farmers ran in elections for agricultural committees, which make crucial decisions concerning land use, loans, etc. Although they won places on a number of committees, they never gained the majorities needed to control them. All the efforts were attempts to win black power. Then in Alabama, the opportunity came to see how blacks could be organized on an independent party basis. An unusual Alabama law provides any group of citizens can nominate candidates for county office, and if they win 20% of the vote, may be recognized as a county political power. The same then applies on a state level. SNCC went to organize in several counties, such as Lowndes, where black people, who form 80% of the population and have an average annual income of $943, felt they could accomplish nothing within the framework of the Alabama Democratic Party because of its racism and because the qualifying fee for this year's elections was raised from $50 to $500 in order to prevent most Negroes from becoming candidates. On May the 3rd, five new county freedom organizations convened and nominated candidates for the offices of sheriff, tax assessor, members of the school boards. These men and women are up for election in November, if they live until then. Their ballot symbol is the Black Panther, a bold, beautiful animal representing the strength and dignity of black demands today. A man needs a Black Panther on his side when he and his family must endure, as hundreds of Alabamans have endured, loss of job, eviction, starvation, and sometimes death for political activity. He may also need a gun, and SNCC reaffirms the right of black men everywhere to defend themselves when threatened or attacked. As for initiating the use of violence, we hope that such programs as ours will make that unnecessary. But it is not for us to tell black communities whether they can or cannot use any particular form of action to resolve their problems. Responsibility for the use of violence by black men, whether in self-defense or initiated by them, lies with the white community. This is the specific historical experience from which SNCC's call for black power emerged on the Mississippi March last July. But the concept of black power is not a recent or isolated phenomenon. It has grown from the ferment of agitation and activity by different people and organizations in many black communities over the year. Our last year of work in Alabama added a new concrete possibility. In Lowndes County, for example, black power will mean that if a Negro is elected sheriff, he can end police brutality. If a black man is elected tax assessor, he can collect and channel funds for the building of better roads and schools serving black people, and thus advancing the move from political power into the economic arena. In such areas as Lowndes, where black men have a majority, they will attempt to use it to exercise control. This is what they seek, control. Where Negroes lack a majority, black power means proper representation and sharing of control. It means the creation of power bases from which black people can work to change statewide or nationwide patterns of oppression through pressure from strength instead of weakness. Politically, black power means what it has always meant to SNCC. The coming together of black people to elect representatives and to force these representatives to speak to their needs. It does not mean merely putting black faces into office. A man or woman who is black and from the slums cannot automatically be expected to speak to the needs of black people. Most of the black politicians we see around the country today are not what SNCC means by black power. The power must be that of a community and emanate from there. SNCC today is working in both North and South on programs of voter registration and independent political organizing. In some places, such as Alabama, Los Angeles, New York, Philadelphia, and New Jersey, independent organizing under the Black Panther symbol is in progress. The creation of a national Black Panther Party must come about. It will take time to build, and it is much too early to predict its success. We have no infallible master plan, and we make no claim to exclusive knowledge as to how to end racism. Different groups will work in their own different ways. SNCC cannot spell out the full logistics of self-determination, but it can address itself to the problem by helping Black communities define their needs, realize their strength, and go into action along a variety of lines which they must choose for themselves. Without knowing all the answers, it can address itself to the basic problem of poverty, to the fact that in Lowndes County, 86 white families own 90% of the land. What are Black people in that county going to do for jobs? Where are they going to get money? There must be reallocation of land and of money. Ultimately, the economic foundation of this country must be shaken if Black people are to control their lives. The colonies of the United States, and this includes the Black ghettos within its borders, North and South, must be liberated. For a century, this nation has been like an octopus of exploitation, its tentacles stretching from Mississippi and Harlem to South America, the Middle East, Southern Africa, Vietnam. The form of exploitation varies from area to area, but the essential result has been the same. A powerful few have been maintained and enriched at the expense of the poor and voiceless colored masses. This pattern must be broken. As its grip loosens here and there around the world, the hopes of Black Americans becomes more realistic. For racism to die, a totally different America must be born. This is what the white society does not wish to face. This is why the society prefers to talk about integration. But integration speaks not at all to the problem of poverty, only to the problem of Blackness. Integration today means the man who makes it, leaving his Black brothers behind in the ghetto as fast as his new sports car will take him. It has no relevance to the Harlem wino or to the cotton picker making $3 a day. As a lady I know in Alabama once said, "The food that Ralph Bunch eats doesn't fill my stomach." Integration, moreover, speaks to the problem of Blackness in a despicable way. As a goal, it has been based on complete acceptance of the fact that in order to have a decent house or education, Blacks must move into a white neighborhood or send their children to a white school. This reinforces among both Black and white the idea that white is automatically better and Black is by definition inferior. This is why integration is a subterfuge for the maintenance of white supremacy. It allows the nation to focus on a handful of Southern children who get into white schools at a great price and to ignore the 94% who are left behind in unimproved all-Black schools. Such situations will not change until Black people have power to control their own school boards, in this case. Then Negroes become equal in a way that means something, and integration ceases to be a one-way street. Then integration doesn't mean draining skills and energies from the ghetto into white schools. Then it can mean white people moving from Beverly Hills into Watts, white people joining the Lowndes County Freedom Organization. Then integration becomes relevant. Last April, before the furor over Black power, Christopher Jenks wrote in a New Republic article on white Mississippi's manipulation of the anti-poverty program. I quote, "The war on poverty has been predicated on a notion that there is such a thing as a community, which can be defined geographically and mobilized for a collective effort to help the poor. This theory has no relation to the reality in the Deep South. In every Mississippi county, there are two communities. Despite all the pious platitudes of the moderates on both sides, these two communities habitually see their interests in terms of conflict rather than cooperation. Only when the Negro community can muster enough political, economic, and professional strength to compete on somewhat equal terms will Negroes believe in the possibility of true cooperation, and whites accept its necessity. En route to integration, the Negro community needs to develop greater independence, a chance to run its own affairs, and not cave in when the man barks. Or so it seems to me, and to most of the knowledgeable people with whom I talked in Mississippi. To OEO, this judgment may sound like black nationalism. End quote. Mr. Jenks, a white reporter, perceived the reason why America's anti-poverty program has been a sick farce in both North and South. In the South, it is clearly racism which prevents the poor from running their own program. In the North, it is more often politicking and bureaucracy. But the results are not so different. In the North, non-whites make up 42% of all families in metropolitan poverty areas, and only 6% of families in areas classified as not poor. SNCC has been working with local residents in Arkansas, Alabama, and Mississippi to achieve control by the poor of the programs and its funds. It has also been working with groups in the North, and the struggle is no less difficult. Behind it all is a federal government which cares far more about winning the war on the Vietnamese than the war on poverty, which has put the poverty program in the hands of self-serving politicians and bureaucrats rather than the poor themselves, which is unwilling to curb the misuse of white power, but quick to condemn black power. To most whites, black power seems to mean the Mau Mau are coming to the suburbs at night. The Mau Mau are coming and the whites must stop them. Articles appear about plots to get whitey, creating an atmosphere in which law and order must be maintained. Once again, responsibility is shifted from the oppressor to the oppressed. Other whites chide, "Don't forget, you're only 10% of the population. If you get too smart, we'll wipe you out." If they are liberals, they complain, "What about me? Don't you want my help anymore?" These are people supposedly concerned about black Americans, but today they think first of themselves, of their feelings of rejection. Or they admonish, "You can't get anywhere without coalitions," when there is, in fact, no group at present with whom to form a coalition in which blacks will not be absorbed and betrayed. Or they accuse us of polarizing the races by our calls for black unity, when the true responsibility for polarization lies with the whites, who will not accept their responsibility as the majority power for making the democratic process work. White America will not face the problem of color, the reality of it. The well-intended say, "We're all human. Everybody is really decent. We must forget color." But color cannot be forgotten until its weight is recognized and dealt with. White America will not acknowledge that the ways in which this country sees itself are contradicted by being black, and always have been. Whereas most of the people who settled this country came here for freedom or for economic opportunity, blacks were brought in here to be slaves. When the Lowndes County Freedom Organization chose the Black Panther as its symbol, it was christened by the press the Black Panther Party. But the Alabama Democratic Party, whose symbol is a rooster, has never been called the White Cock Party. No one ever talked about white power, because power in this country is white. All this adds up to more than merely identifying a group phenomenon by some catchy name or adjective. The furor over that problem reveals the problems that white America has with color and sex. The furor over black power reveals how deep racism runs and the great fear which is attached to it. Whites will not see that I, for example, as a person oppressed because of my blackness, have common cause with other blacks who are oppressed because of blackness. This is not to say that there are no white people who see things as I do, but it is black people I must speak to first. It must be to the oppressed to whom SNCC addresses itself primarily, not to the friends from the oppressing group. From birth, black people are told a set of lies about themselves. We're told that we are lazy. Yet I drive through the Delta area of Mississippi and watch black people picking cotton in the hot sun for 14 hours. We are told, "If you work hard, you'll succeed." But if that were true, black people would own this country. We are oppressed because we are black. Not because we are ignorant, not because we're lazy, not because we're stupid and got good rhythm, but because we're black. I remember that when I was a boy, I used to go to see Tarzan movies on Saturday. White Tarzan used to beat up the black natives. I would sit there yelling, "Kill him!"
I was saying kill me. It was as if a Jewish boy watched Nazis taking Jews off to a concentration camp and cheering them on. Today I want the chief to beat the hell out of Tarzan and send him back to Europe. But it takes time to become free of the lies and their shaming effect on black minds. It takes time to reject the most important lie, that black people inherently can't do the same things white people can do unless white people help them. The need for psychological equality is the reason why SNCC today believes that blacks must reorganize in the black community. Only black people can convey the revolutionary idea that black people are able to do things themselves. Only they can help create in the community an aroused and continuing black consciousness that will provide the basis for political strength. In the past, white allies have furthered white supremacy without the whites involved realizing it or wanting it, I think. Black people must do things for themselves. They must get poverty money they will control and spend themselves. They must conduct tutorial programs themselves so that black children can identify with black people. This is one reason why Africa has such importance. The reality of black men ruling their own natives gives blacks elsewhere a sense of possibility, of power, which they do not now have. This does not mean we don't welcome help or friends, but we want the right to decide whether anyone is in fact our friend. In the past, black Americans have been almost the only people whom everybody and his mama could jump up and call their friends. We have been tokens, symbols, objects, as I was in high school to many young whites who'd like to have a, quote, Negro friend. We want to decide who is our friend, and we will not accept someone who comes to us and says, if you do X, Y, and Z, then I'll help you. We will not be told whom we should choose as allies. We will not be isolated from any group or nation except by our own choice. We cannot have the oppressors telling the oppressed how to rid themselves of the oppressor. I have said that most liberal whites react to black power with the question, what about me, rather than saying, tell me what you want me to do and I'll see if I can do it. There are answers to the right question. One of the most disturbing things about almost all white supporters of the movement has been that they're afraid to go into their communities, which is where the racism exists, and work to get rid of it. They want to run from Berkeley to tell us what to do in Mississippi. Let them look instead at Berkeley. They admonish blacks to be nonviolent. Let them preach on nonviolence in the white community. They come to teach me Negro history. Let them go to the suburbs and open up freedom schools for whites. Let them work to stop America's racist foreign policy. Let them press this government to cease supporting the economy of South Africa. This is a vital job to be done among poor whites. We hope to see eventually a coalition between poor blacks and poor whites. That is the only coalition which seems acceptable to us, and we see such a coalition as the major internal instrument of change in America. SNCC has tried several times to organize poor whites. We are trying again now with an initial training program in Tennessee. It is purely academic to talk about bringing poor blacks and whites together, but the job of creating a poor white power bloc must be attempted. The main responsibility for it falls upon whites. Black and white can work together in the white community wherever possible. It is not possible, however, to go into a poor southern town and talk about integration. Poor whites everywhere are becoming more hostile, not less, partly because they see the nation's attention focused on black poverty and nobody coming to them. Too many young middle-class Americans, like some sort of Pepsi generation, have wanted to come alive through the black community. They've wanted to be where the action is, and the action has been in the black community. Black people do not want to take over this country. They don't want to get whitey. They just want to get him off their backs, as the saying goes. It was, for example, the exploitation by Jewish landlords and merchants which first created black resentment toward the Jews, not Judaism. The white man is irrelevant to blacks, except as an oppressive force. Blacks want to be in his place, yes, but not in order to terrorize and lynch and starve him. They want to be in his place because that is where a decent life can be had. But our vision is not merely of a society in which all black men have enough to buy all the good things of life. When we urge that black money go into black pockets, we mean the communal pocket. We want to see money go back into the community and used to benefit it. We want to see the cooperative concept applied in business and banking. We want to see black ghetto residents demand that an exploiting storekeeper sell them at minimal cost a building or a shop that they will own and improve cooperatively. They can back their demand with a rent strike or a boycott or a community so unified behind them that no one else will move into that building or buy at that store.